Earth is radio fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime. If you'd like a copy of the specially printed QSL card and a six-page information sheet by return of post, please send 50 pence in British stamps or three international reply coupons to Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG.
And from Broadcast Engineering, The Evolution of Broadcast Transmission Lines by Geza Dines. The transfer of RF energy is an art and a science, with a little plumbing tossed in as well. Today's sophisticated circular waveguide represents great strides in the development of broadcast transmission line technology. We have come a long way since the days of two-wire line. How did we get there? The answer to that question lies in the evolution of broadcast transmission line technology. The early days. In the early days of DC, it was obvious that a pipeline must be provided for the electrons moving from the source of supply, the negative side of a battery, to the load, and then to a place of disposal, the positive side of the battery. Two metallic wires connected one side of the load to each pole of the battery. The wires did not need to be of equal length, nor was their relative position important. Remember the lab experiments with scattered wires, connections and switches you performed during Electronics 101 class in college. This is, of course, in America. Soon, however, came wireless, working on the principle that alternating current flow creates an alternating electromagnetic field, which travels through space and is detectable from far away. A new means of information transfer and communication was born. Because wireless transmission is similar to seeds thrown into the wind, the concept of broadcasting was applied to generating time-varying electromagnetic fields throughout a large region in space. The industry had a name. The two-wire line. The efficient and controlled conversion of energy from alternating current to electromagnetic fields is performed by the antenna. For convenience, among other reasons, the antenna typically is located some distance away from the RF generator. Transferring the energy from the generator to the antenna requires some type of transmission line. One solution was the two-wire line. The behaviour of transmission lines is described by the so-called telegrapher's equation, developed circa 1897. The equation is based on Maxwell's description of electromagnetic propagation and provides solutions for various parameters of transmission lines, including the velocity of propagation, impedance, and attenuation. Simplified versions of this equation were adapted and developed for specific transmission line configurations, such as the two-wire coaxial lines and various types of waveguide. The two-wire term refers to a transmission line that consists of two parallel wires separated by a constant distance that is small compared to the wavelength. All alternating current flow causes radiation, but because the current flow in the two wires is in opposite directions, the electromagnetic field generated by one wire tends to oppose and cancel the field generated by the other wire. As long as the distance between the wires of the two-wire line is small in relation to a wavelength, the net radiation from the transmission line is negligible. The two-wire transmission line was extensively employed in the early days because of its many attractive features. The frequencies used for broadcasting were generally less than 30 MHz, so a wire spacing of 6 to 8 inches was small enough to prevent unwanted radiation, and at the same time large enough to avoid voltage breakdown. The line could be homemade with a minimum of equipment, and the materials required were readily available. The advantages of this transmission line, such as simplicity, low cost, ease of manufacture, and high power handling capability, were designed to offset some of its deficiencies, which included environmental exposure, general vulnerability, and personnel safety considerations. The need for a better transmission line. By the early 1930s, radio had taken over the land. As the number of transmitting stations mushroomed, so did the potential for interference. To minimise the possibility of one station interfering with others, rules governing radiation were developed. These requirements often included the need for specialised antenna patterns and a change in radiation patterns during nighttime operation. To fill the need, multi-tower AM broadcast arrays were developed. These multi-element or multi-tower AM arrays produced the correct antenna pattern only when the proper phase and amplitude relationship was maintained among the tower members. Delivering the RF energy to each tower in the proper manner was the task of the transmission line. Precisely preset conditions must be maintained over time, regardless of changes in the environment surrounding the antenna system. Because the typical two-wire line was exposed to the elements, and there was some interaction among the multiple two-wire lines, it was not surprising that difficulties were encountered in producing an electrically stable transmission line system for feeding multi-element AM arrays. The environment, snow, ice, and intercoupling, tended to change the preset phase and amplitude delivered to each element of the array from day to night and from season to season. A more stable, environmentally tolerant transmission line was needed to improve control of RF transmissions. During this same time, the telephone communication industry also needed a better transmission line. The desire to lay undersea cable to provide telephone communications among continents created the need for a transmission line that could withstand extreme outside pressures, could be electrically shielded and sealed against the elements, and would exhibit a reasonably low attenuation. Coaxial line was the natural candidate. Coaxial transmission line. The coaxial transmission line consists of two concentrically arranged cylinders. The shielding is provided by the outer cylinder or outer conductor. Because all electrical fields are confined between the two cylinders, current does not flow on the outside of the outer cylinder. The entire line can be made to withstand large pressures. The 50 ohm impedance, a compromise between power carrying capability and attenuation, became the industry standard. Up until the mid-1950s, a combination of two impedances, 51.5 ohms because of the available commercial tubing, and 50 ohms because of the newly established industry standard, was used. The 75 ohm coaxial line, typically used by the television industry, was chosen because it provided the lowest attenuation. Commercial availability of coaxial transmission line dates to the mid-1930s. Victor J. Andrew, founder of Andrew Corporation, handmade his first coaxial line components in January 1937. These were coaxial components with flanges, hand-soldered onto each end of the outer conductor tubing, with the center conductor supported on ceramic beads. The entire ceramic bead and center conductor assembly was then pulled into the outer conductor. The proliferation of AM stations between 1930 and 1940 provided a growing market for commercial coaxial line components. The majority of transmitters tended to be low power by today's standards, with power outputs typically less than 5 kilowatts. FM broadcasting appeared in the mid-1930s and later proved to be commercially viable. The 1940s brought about major advancements in transmission line technology. World War II, the development of television, and the frequency change for FM broadcasting from 50 MHz to the 88 to 108 MHz frequency band all motivated this research and development effort. The requirements of military operations and the invention of radar prompted a great deal of research, most of it by MIT, into both coaxial and waveguide transmission lines for high power and high frequency. The frequency change of FM broadcast from the 50 MHz to 100 MHz band was significant because the two-wire transmission line had either too much extraneous radiation or was too closely spaced for power breakdown at these frequencies. Also, it was just too vulnerable to the elements. The industry developed standards covering the power levels and frequency bands of various sizes of coaxial lines. These standards included a 75 ohm 6-inch diameter coaxial line for television use, a 180 ohm 3-inch diameter line for radar use, and a 50 ohm line for general purpose use. Over the years, a wide variety of coaxial lines became available, ranging from 1/16 inch to 9 inches in diameter. The largest known coax, 14 inches in diameter, was manufactured in 1961 for a cyclotron carrying 50 megawatts of RF power. The flexible continuous length coaxial cable, using a solid dielectric material for insulation and a braided outer conductor, also dates to that time period. Flexible coaxial cable for broadcast. One of the most significant advances in coax manufacturing technology was the development of a manufacturing technique that allowed the production of long, continuous lengths of large coaxial cables. Two types of cables were developed over the years. One had a smooth outer conductor and the other had a corrugated outer conductor for greater flexibility. This meant cables could be manufactured in sizes up to 9 inches in diameter. These flexible cables could be installed in continuous lengths up to several hundred feet and required only one connection to the mating equipment at each end. The cable could be shipped on reels in a compact manner, reducing both shipping and installation costs. An outer jacket of a plastic material protected the cable from the elements. This was a boon to the broadcast industry because the cable provided high reliability, reduced maintenance and installation costs, and also made direct burial possible. These cables are marketed under a variety of trade names. The typical manufacturing technique for such cable includes continuous seam welding of thin copper strips to form the inner and outer conductors, with a continuous dielectric material and annular or helical corrugations to provide flexibility. During World War II, the FCC stopped issuing construction permits for new broadcast stations. The pent-up demand caused explosive growth after the war, when hundreds of AM, FM and television stations mushroomed all over the United States. The public accepted television with open arms, and the number of television receiving sets increased from 10,000 in 1946 to more than 12 million by 1951. The growth of the television broadcast industry became so vigorous that in 1948, the Commission was forced to freeze the issuance of television construction permits pending implementation of interference regulations. Subsequently, competing stations covering the same market were vying with one another to provide better quality sound, picture, and reception. This placed demands on the performance of the transmission line. To improve performance, the manufacturers responded with more sophisticated coaxial line designs that included polyethylene inner conductor supports instead of ceramic bead supports, improved inner connector bullet designs, pressurization equipment to protect the large and expensive transmission line installations and grounding systems to protect against lightning. Power levels were also increasing to provide better coverage and greater signal strength to the user. The increasing output of transmitters required larger coaxial transmission lines to handle the higher powers and more precisely controlled manufacturing techniques to better control the propagation parameters.
Esta es la leyenda de Xanadu.
Here my voice on the wind.
coaxial line for UHF television. By the mid-1950s, many of the major markets were using all the available VHF television channels. In order to enter one of these television markets, the broadcaster had to apply for one of the UHF channels. UHF television frequencies, being much higher than VHF frequencies, have three disadvantages. First, the propagation of UHF frequencies is not as favourable as VHF frequencies, especially over the horizon. Second, television sets are not as sensitive to UHF frequencies as they are to VHF frequencies. Third, the free space attenuation, the apparent loss of signal as a function of distance, is greater for the UHF frequencies than for VHF. In order to provide comparable performance, the Commission allowed a greater effective radiated power for the UHF stations. In fact, the ratio is almost 20 to 1. Some of the allowable increased ERP may be generated by using a higher gain antenna. However, the antenna alone cannot offset this large difference, so still higher power transmitters were developed for the UHF frequencies. Thus, while transmitter powers for a typical VHF station are in the 30 kilowatt to 60 kilowatt range, the power output for a UHF station is in the 50 kilowatt to 220 kilowatt range. Carrying the output of such high power transmitters to the antenna places tremendous demands on the transmission line. The limitation of coaxial line. The designer of coaxial transmission line was caught between the jaws of a vice. To produce a coaxial transmission line with 75 ohm impedance, typically used for UHF broadcasting, the inner conductor diameter is 3.6 times smaller than the diameter of the outer conductor. That, of course, means that the resistance of the inner conductor is 3.6 times higher than the resistance of the outer conductor. However, both conductors have to carry the same current. The heat generated by this current, or the I squared R losses, are, therefore, nearly four times higher on the center conductor than on the outer conductor. The center conductor thus tends to heat up. The coaxial line is like a vacuum thermos bottle, in the sense that there basically is only one means of heat escape from the center conductor, and that is radiation. Radiation, however, is a very inefficient means of heat transfer, and the center conductor needs to be reasonably hot for the transfer to take place at all. If the center conductor gets too hot, oxidation occurs. A softening of the insulating material that supports the center conductor also may take place. Limits, therefore, must be placed on the amount of power that may be carried by a coaxial line. The natural response to this problem would be to manufacture a larger diameter line that would have a larger diameter inner conductor and, therefore, less I squared R heat loss. Unfortunately, if the outer and inner diameters of the coax are increased too much, a new mode of propagation may exist in the coaxial line, which is highly undesirable. The designer must carefully select the size of a high-power coaxial line to be as large as possible, but not to exceed that dimension that allows an unwanted mode of propagation. Once the proper coaxial transmission line size has been determined, one more serious problem remains, which also is the result of heat developed on the center conductor. Because the center conductor runs at a temperature that is typically as much as 65.5 degrees centigrade to 104 degrees centigrade, hotter than the outer conductor, there will be relative length change between the two conductors. The center conductor will grow in length as a result of its higher temperature. To accommodate the expansion at each junction point between consecutive coaxial line segments, a sliding center conductor contact must be provided. This sliding contact allows the center conductor to expand and contract as its temperature varies while providing continuity from one segment to another. The inner conductor temperature is not constant with time but varies as a function of transmitter power output. When the station goes off the air, the inner conductor cools off, and when power is applied again, it heats up and expands. This causes a cyclic variation of the inner conductor length and causes the end of the center conductor to slide back and forth on the stationary center conductor, often referred to as a bullet. which is caught between the mating section flanges. Unfortunately, the periodic sliding action can cause metal shavings to flake off both the center conductor and the connector and roughen the sliding surfaces. These metal shavings fall on the insulators and, if enough accumulates, provide a current path across the support insulator. The result will be a flashover and a destroyed transmission line. Also, the increased contact resistance caused by the roughened-up sliding surfaces will generate extra heat, which could eventually result in a portion of the center conductor melting, another threat to the line. Most major high-power transmission line failures occur due to one or both of these conditions. Coaxial line for UHF television. To provide a coaxial transmission line with the highest possible reliability, development is underway for a coaxial line without sliding contacts. The result is a new series of coaxial line. This line uses an inner connector, bullet, similar to the traditional sliding inner connector, but the new connector, once inserted into the mating section, has a contact pressure high enough to prevent sliding. Center conductor growth and shrinkage is accommodated by a built-in bellows. The bellows segment acts like an accordion, stretching and compressing as needed. This design eliminates the sliding action that is the root cause of most transmission line failures. To date, thousands of feet of 6 and 1/8 inch line has been installed in high-power UHF installations up to 80 kilowatts without a single reported failure. And with the final part of Evolution of Broadcast Transmission Lines by Geezer Dines from Broadcast Engineering. Rectangular waveguide. At the turn of the century, several investigators predicted the possibility of guiding electromagnetic waves inside hollow metallic pipes. The cross-sectional dimension of the pipe would have to be about half a wavelength. For low frequencies, long wavelengths, the pipe size would have to be enormous, on the order of tens or even hundreds of feet, this simply was not practical. During World War II, much emphasis was placed on the development of high-frequency generating equipment to be used for radar. The development of transmission lines for the guiding of high frequencies was a byproduct of radar development. MIT and other research centres conducted theoretical studies as well as practical experiments with waveguides of various shapes and types. By 1945, there was sufficient theoretical and practical know-how available to apply these newly developed transmission line technologies in the commercial field. Waveguides provide low attenuation and exceptionally high power capability. They do not have a center conductor, so the problem of cooling the center conductor is eliminated. All resistive heat loss is developed on the surface of the hollow pipe, which is in direct contact with the outside environment. Heat transfer may take place from the hollow pipe to the environment via both convection and radiation, so cooling is quite efficient. In addition, the attenuation of waveguide is much lower than the attenuation of coaxial line for a given frequency. Therefore, less heat is developed on the waveguide conductor itself. Waveguide appeared to be an ideal transmission line. As the power output of UHF television stations increased to the 110 kilowatt and 220 kilowatt levels, waveguide, as a reliable alternative to coaxial transmission line, became more attractive. Rectangular waveguide with a cross-section of roughly 15 inches by 7.5 inches, although much larger than a 6-inch or 8-inch diameter coaxial line, could provide reliable service with low attenuation. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, several UHF television stations were using rectangular waveguide. To date, these stations report high reliability. Typically, the waveguide is manufactured from welded aluminium sheet metal. It is somewhat more expensive than coaxial line, but produces greater reliability, especially at high power levels. VHF and UHF television competition. The 1960s and 70s saw a proliferation of UHF television stations. Many of these stations were constructed in markets dominated by long-established VHF stations. In order to compete, the UHF stations had to offset the disadvantages of broadcasting at the higher frequency. Owners of these stations began to realize that successful competition required excellence in coverage and that superior coverage was the result of the proper balance among several important performance requirements. First, it is desirable to radiate the maximum practical ERP, in some cases emitting the maximum legal ERP of 5 megawatts is essential. Second, it is mandatory that the antenna system be designed to provide the optimum coverage. This requirement implies the use of UHF television antennas with moderate but never high elevation directivity and a great deal of null fill. Because ERP is a product of power input to the antenna and antenna gain, which is limited by the requirement to provide optimum coverage, the only way to achieve a high ERP is to use more RF power. So, in the final analysis, the UHF television station owner was forced to use a very high power transmitter to be successful in the major markets. The choice of transmission line had become limited. A coaxial line of the largest possible diameter, typically 8 or 9 inches, was only marginally adequate at these power levels. The other choice was waveguide. After considering the cost of being off the air for transmission line repairs, more and more high power stations opted for rectangular waveguide. One additional factor also influenced the choice. The effectiveness of television coverage, especially that of UHF, is significantly increased with antenna height. Realizing this, many stations not blessed with nearby mountains built tall towers, up to 2,200 feet in height. This, of course, required long transmission lines. The attenuation of the transmission line became significant, and rectangular waveguide, having a much lower attenuation, offered an additional advantage over coaxial line. Circular waveguide. Although rectangular waveguide seemed to be a panacea for all transmission line problems, it is not without disadvantages. The most disturbing one is the inability of rectangular waveguide to retain its shape under internal pressure. Pressurizing a transmission line is done to prevent the entry of moisture and is considered essential to long-term reliability. These large metal waveguide sections tend to bow outward as a result of internal pressure and assume a slightly rounded shape. Flanges and flange connections are much stronger than the sheet metal waveguide body and will retain their rectangular cross-section even under considerable internal forces. As the rectangular waveguide is pressurized, the cross-section of the rectangular waveguide body will change from an essentially perfect rectangle at the flange joints to a slightly rounded shape, change back again at the next flange joint, and so on. The net result is that periodic discontinuities develop along the line, causing high voltage standing wave ratio and ghosting. This phenomenon occurs even at fairly low pressures, of the order of 1 pound per square inch or less. So sophisticated pressurization systems had to be developed, with dump valves to prevent excessive pressure in the line. Without a dump system, excessive pressure could develop due simply to rising ambient temperature. The rectangular cross-section also is less than an ideal aerodynamic shape. The wind load produced by a rectangular waveguide is much larger than for a coaxial line, because it is larger and because of its rectangular shape. As a result, waveguide requires stronger and more expensive towers to support it. In addition, the associated slightly loose supporting system could allow the rectangular waveguide to develop excessive lateral movement, causing severe vibrations on the tower. Circular waveguide, developed to address some of these problems, is simply a cylindrical tube of sufficiently large diameter to allow the propagation of electromagnetic waves. The advantage of circular waveguide is its round cross-section, which provides for a smoother airflow around it, causing a far lower wind load than rectangular waveguide for the same frequency. In addition, circular waveguide will withstand large internal pressures without deformation. This eliminates the periodic discontinuity problem caused by pressurization. Furthermore, a circular waveguide of the proper dimensions will provide lower attenuation than a rectangular waveguide of approximately the same dimensions. Because of its round shape, circular waveguide is able to propagate energy in two polarizations simultaneously. At this time, however, only one of the polarizations is used for UHF television applications. Circular waveguides have been used for microwave transmission as far back as the early 1950s by the Bell system. Many long-haul microwave systems constructed since then use a circular waveguide 2.8 inches in diameter in conjunction with a horn antenna on 4 GHz and 6 GHz communication routes. The first commercially available circular waveguide system for 6 GHz was developed in 1960 for the Wisconsin Bell Telephone Company and was installed in the Madison area. The first circular transmission line systems were brought to the market in 1982 for UHF television transmission. Soon after installation, however, ghosting and time-varying voltage standing wave ratio problems were noted, and the cause was traced to trapped energy inside the waveguide. As a result, some planned circular waveguide installations were either put on hold or were redesigned to use a different transmission line approach, pending resolution of the moding problem. A new design was introduced to the market in 1983, incorporating a 90-degree circular waveguide bend, which is used to connect the vertical run on the tower to a horizontal circular waveguide run leading to the transmitter building. Until this time, either coax or rectangular waveguide was used to connect the bottom end of the vertical circular waveguide run to the transmitter. The first transmission line system consisting entirely of circular waveguide was installed in 1983 at KIHS TV in Los Angeles. Where do we go from here? Most VHF television stations, as well as FM and AM broadcasting stations, are adequately served by the coaxial transmission line currently available. So most new development will take place in transmission lines for UHF television and special applications. The trend towards centralising FM broadcast facilities is one possible special application. In some large markets, several FM broadcasters unite to install a common antenna and transmission line system using a broadband master antenna that is centrally located. The transmission line for these systems must carry the combined power of up to 8 FM transmitters. Increased reliability and power handling capacity of the large coaxial lines used for this purpose are needed, and perhaps other forms of transmission lines are also needed. Other possibilities include the use of a single waveguide run for more than one UHF channel simultaneously. This might be accomplished with filterplexes on the input and output of a rectangular waveguide run. Circular waveguide is capable of propagating two polarizations that are decoupled by 20 dB to 40 dB and could be used to transmit the frequencies of two UHF channels without the use of filterplexes. Many obstacles must be conquered to achieve acceptable performance with either approach. The variety of requirements and solutions to transmission line problems in the ever-changing and demanding field of broadcasting will continue to require dogged determination and ingenuity.
You think I never see you when you accidentally fall? Me say,
aye, check.
Make your puppy a bit of gold.
Aye, check.
Why you accidentally fall?
Aye, check.
You should crying out for
ice water.
Goat a go running belly, me say,
I bet.
Make your puppy bitter gold.
I bet.
Why you accidentally fall?
I bet.
Is she crying out for
ice water?
Is Radio Fax 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
With Trevor Brooke.
And Maggie Stevenson. A book was published recently by E.S. Turner on BBC Children's Hour, a celebration of the magical years. And an article appeared following it in the Sunday Times entitled Farewell to Uncle Mac and Tammy Troot. What caused the biggest public outcry in the annals of the BBC? No, not Father Knox's 1926 drama about Red Revolution in London, nor the satire shows of the 1960s, but the poleaxing in 1964 of Children's Hour on radio. Earlier, a directive had gone out saying that children were not to be addressed as children, a usage thought to be identified with the bad old days when the air was infested with aunties and uncles. The Daily Telegraph's radio critic warned that it was all part of the downward extension of teenagery, which would eventually embrace and corrupt the very tots. Another directive had banned the Children's Hour presenters from fronting their own shows, so their long familiar voices were lost.
Perhaps it served them right for being, in the words of a controller of BBC, so rather middle class. Children, for want of a better word, were of course defecting in droves to television programmes for the young. Frank Gillard, seen in this book as the fiend with the axe, argued that Children's Hour had only 25,000 followers, of whom many were sentimental adults. In vain the defenders pleaded that their programmes at least made the young use their imagination, instead of having their imagination done for them. Wallace Grevatt's thick tome is described as a celebration of the magical years. He's a man much in love with his subject, and as knowledgeable as one would expect a Radio Times archivist to be. But he's given us, instead of a lively celebration, a grand catalogue of names. The most ardent wallower in nostalgia is likely to wilt confronted by this record of programmes and their originators, region by region, decade by decade. And for the reader seeking shortcuts, there's no helpful index. Two amiably goofy-looking young men emerge as the devisers of the first radio programmes for children, broadcast from Birmingham in November 1922. For some time, such programmes tended to office romps with far too much backchat in eradicable BBC vice. Cardiff, believe it or not, called its programme The Hour of the Kiddywinks, and Newcastle had a fairy flower league. Some broadcasters assumed that listeners were under the care of nurses and were waiting to have nice hot baths. The Reithian idea was entertainment with a sprinkling of information. The best remembered series is surely Toy Town, the creation of S.G. Holm, Beaverman, with its cycle of 30 stories endlessly repeated, and the voice of Larry the Lamb, rendered by that Somme veteran, Derek McCulloch, otherwise Uncle Mac. Wurzel Gummidge surfaced in 1935 and made it to television. There were the Jennings School Tales, the 130 Adventures of the Boy Detectives Norman and Harry Burns, Henry's voice by Patricia Hayes, the talks by Zoo Man, and in the north by Romany. Scots programmers, scorning Kenneth Graham's Mole and Badger, looked for lovable creatures in a Scots burn and found Tammy Troot. In perennial demand were that elegantly named doyen of playwrights, L. Dugard Peach, the serial writer Aubrey Feast, and commander, later Sir, Stephen King Hall, the Gyland veteran who was allowed to talk on world affairs. What did he tell his listeners about Hitler? Kathleen Garskedden, the one-time Auntie Cyclone of Scottish radio, was the only person to have spanned the whole period of Children's Hour in one capacity or another. The name of Violet Carson of Coronation Street kept cropping up, even in nursery sing-song. The finest period of Children's Hour may have been in the Second World War, when evacuees and children in Europe were all linked by McCulloch's Goodnight Children Everywhere. Did anyone think children a condescending form of address then? God was still around in the 1950s. A bishop's conference at Lambeth sparked five programmes, a gesture which, if not rather middle class, rather smacked of children's newspaper. One would like to be able to commend the book more warmly, but the trees have a way of concealing the magic wood. Towards the end, the author allows his indignation to mount as he records the growing insolences of radio management, or, as Dennis Potter put it, the years of sly erosion. In 1960, Children's Hour was twice thrown out to make way for Rip Wimbledon commentaries. As cultural betrayals go, the eventual slaughter of Children's Hour will be seen by some as ranking with the decision of the film moguls to ditch their older audiences. Surely, one of our more savage cartoonists should have portrayed the BBC in the guise of Goya's horrendous Saturn consuming his young. Well, that was a review of the E.S. Turner book, BBC Children's Hour, A Celebration of Magical Years.
And in Television Magazine, the long-distance television column by Roger Bunny has some comments about 405-line VHF television system, which officially closed down on January the 6th, 1985, though several relays continued for a few days. Bands 1 and 3 are still allocated to television broadcasting in the European Broadcasting Region and are extensively used by countries in both West and East Europe. Will the newly established Band 1 mobile radio services be subjected to severe disruption during the summer months as a result of sporadic e-propagation, he asks. Personally, I'm finding that Band 1 is becoming cluttered up. In the more built-up areas, it's becoming an RF dustbin. Apart from computers that radiate spurious signals throughout the VHF spectrum over quite some distance, it seems that the United Kingdom is well behind the FCC standards, the 49 MHz segment is becoming choked with baby alarms, toy walkie-talkies, pagers and cordless telephones. I've even seen a 49 MHz FM radio three-channel intercom system for domestic use. A local baby alarm radiates over a half-mile radius, producing a noise-free raster here. Despite all this, the DTI seems to be quite happy. And airborne television. We have previously described the activities of the Blue Eagle flight, which during the Vietnam War provided wide television coverage from transmitters aboard high-flying aircraft. Recently, the United States magazine Popular Electronics described a series of tests that were carried out much earlier, in the mid-1940s, with a view to achieving wide television coverage from airborne transmitters. Staff of Westinghouse Radio designed a prototype system in July 1945. The Stratovision project would use aircraft equipped with FM, radio and television transmitters flying at 25 to 30,000 feet. Narrow beamwidth signals would be received on a particular channel and retransmitted on another channel with coverage over a vast area. Details were shown to the Glenn L. Martin Aircraft Company, which by spring 1946 had equipped a World War II surplus bomber with band 2, 107.5 MHz, and channel A21, 515 MHz, transmitters. Initial test flights proved that successful reception was possible over an area of about 250 miles. Areas flown over during these tests included Philadelphia, Wilmington, New York, Washington, North Carolina, Baltimore, Pittsburgh, and Detroit. It seemed that 8 Stratovision aircraft would give coast-to-coast coverage, while 14 would cover three-quarters of the United States landmass. The transmitting aerials were mounted on a 10-foot mast that hinged down from the bomb bay. The encouraging results led to the conversion of a much larger B-29 aeroplane. In a 1948 test at Pittsburgh, it relayed signals uplinked from Baltimore over an area that extended from South Virginia to New York State. At about this time, the United States Air Force also experimented with airborne television transmissions. The Stratovision project was considered to be a success, but was overtaken by progress with land-based communications technology in the shape of a nationwide microwave network. The experience gained was, however, put to use in the very successful Blue Eagle service of the late 1960s. This same magazine mentions that the first terrestrial UHF television transmitter, KC2XAK, at Bridgeport, Connecticut, was tried out in December 1949. The vision carrier frequency was 530.25 MHz, approximately channel A24. Channel A4 programs from WNBT television in New York were relayed over a distance of 45 miles via a 2 GHz link between the 85th floor of the Empire State Building and a 9-foot dish mounted at 180 foot up the 250-foot transmitting mast at Success Hill. Transmitter power was 1 kilowatt peak vision with 500 watt sound. The omnidirectional aerial providing a gain of 20 decibels. The results were found to be equal to, or better than, existing VHF services. And following this experiment, the FCC opened up UHF for television broadcasting, with channel allocations made in 1951-52. Those comments by Roger Bunny in Long Distance Television in Television Magazine.
I said upside down, you're turning me, you're giving love instinctively, round and round, you're turning me, upside down, boy, you turn me, inside out, and round and round, upside down, boy, you turn me, inside out, and round and round, instinctively you give to me, the love that I need. I cherish the moments with you. Respectfully, I say to thee, I'm aware that you're cheating when no one makes me feel like you do.
me inside out and round and round, upside down. Boy, you turn me inside out and round and round. Instinctively, you give to me the love that I need. I cherish the moment with you. Respectfully, I say to thee, I'm aware that you're cheating, but no one makes me feel like you do. Upside down, boy, you turn me inside out and round, round, upside down. Boy, you turn me inside out and round, upside down. Boy, you turn me
by Jane Bird, technology editor of the Sunday Times, on the live wire of the cable revolution. Michael Davis is making the cable revolution happen in Britain. As chairman of the Cable Corporation, which holds the franchise for Windsor, Berkshire, he has created the world's most advanced cable network. In addition to a great number of television channels, Windsor's cable subscribers have an alternative telephone service to British Telecom. Now Davis has a more ambitious plan. He's hoping to win the franchise for Birmingham, due to be allotted this month. It will involve a total investment of £150 million to lay cables past 460,000 homes, an area more than three times the size of any existing cable network. Davis had a tough time raising £25 million in equity and secured borrowings to set up Windsor Television in 1983. In the early days, the city was wary of the unproven technology, and American backers were hostile to the idea of combining telephone with television, he says. Laying cable requires a huge investment at the beginning, but once you have the delivery infrastructure in place, there is no related cost. The argument seems finally to have convinced the financial community, especially the Americans, who are now piling in, according to Davis. Funds from Cable Casting of Canada and Jones Intercable of Denver are included in the £34 million he's raised for Birmingham. Davis reckons the Cable Corporation's performance in Windsor makes it the natural choice for Birmingham. By 1991, we should be in profit and ready to go public soon after, he says. Windsor's network was made possible by Britain's 1983 legislation to liberalise broadcasting and telecommunications. Its aim was to turn Britain into a wired society, with lots of services based on the television set and telephone fed into homes and businesses on one cable. John Davey, the Director General of the Cable Authority, the government's regulatory body, says Windsor Television is the only cable franchisee providing both telephone and television on a significant scale. The authority has so far allotted 23 franchises, of which Windsor is one of the biggest. Using Mercury Network, Windsor Television provides a telephone service that reaches round the world. It also offers 22 television channels, mostly beamed from satellites and picked up by its two dishes in nearby Slough, and 9 radio stations. It has 320 miles of ducts, and by the end of this year hopes to have cables passing 75,000 homes and 5,000 businesses. Davis says he expects about 20% of these to be connected. At the moment, the telephones carry only incoming calls, but by the year end they will be outgoing too. Yet most people in Windsor still don't know what Davis's salesmen are talking about. It comes as a great surprise to most businessmen to discover there is an alternative to BT, let alone realising the huge potential in cable television, he says. Among the advantages Davis can offer telephone users are calls costing 15 to 20% less than BT, itemised bills, and, because the cables are of optical fibre, clearer lines. Cable also has pluses for would-be satellite television viewers. If they want to subscribe next year to both Astra and BSB, they face having to buy two dishes and mount them on their roofs, pointing in different directions. With cable, they can have both services and many more with no dish. Connecting to cable is simple. The ducts laid in the road have spurs going up to the boundary of every property. Indoors, the only noticeable difference with telephone and television should be improved sound and vision. There are many possibilities for extra services. The Cable Corporation is investing in security. A factory manager will not only know a burglar or fire alarm has gone off, but he'll be able to see in his own home pictures of what's going on. Teleshopping, which with high-quality television pictures will have more consumer appeal for everything, from groceries to a new suit. Information such as timetables, travel bookings or worldwide weather reports. Low-cost teleconferencing and video training. Many of these require the user to send messages back along the cable to a remote computer, so the next phase of the technology is to let users interact. For this, they will simply use their telephones to select numbers displayed on the television screen. To make it economically viable, however, Davis needs a lot more users, which is why he has his sights on the Birmingham franchise. Windsor has been a practical operation to iron out all the bugs concerned with making the connections between BT, Mercury, and our own cable, he says. The biggest problem has not been the technology, but the sheer volume of administrative detail involved in providing the features required to comply with international standards. He says he's ready to start laying cables in Birmingham immediately and begin connecting users next year. Once that's underway, we will have enough people to make it worth investing in making the systems interactive. Cable customers will have the interactive facility as an optional extra. Initially, the Cable Corporation wanted to license provision of these services to other companies, but it has had to make its own investment because third parties have been slow to respond. It has, however, so far resisted going into local television production, which has dragged several other franchises into cash crisis.
And now it's an Edifax million-selling single.
Al Martino, Spanish Eyes, released on the Capitol label in the USA and the UK in the year 1965. Musical director, composer Bert Kempfert originally wrote this as an instrumental item called Moon Over Naples for his Polydor LP, Magic Music of Faraway Places. And also it was issued as a single disc and it became a worldwide bestseller. Then Charles Singleton and Eddie Snyder wrote lyrics for the tune, giving it a new title, Spanish Eyes. And Al Martino's disc was a big, big success. It got to number 11 for 2 weeks in the USA, with 12 weeks in the bestsellers. It also sold 800,000 copies in Germany, and total sales of 1,500,000 were reported by the end of 1967. He also recorded an album of the same name for Capitol in 1965. Spanish Eyes was also re-released in Britain in 1973, where it became a top five hit single, being even more successful than its first UK release in 1965. It was Al Martino's second million seller, his first one being Here in My Heart in 1952, which became also the first number one in charts as charts began in that year, 1952. Al Martino, Spanish Eyes.
Please
This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
Subwoofer performance for accurate reproduction of music. In the Journal of the Audio Engineering Society by Louis D. Fielder from Dolby Laboratories Incorporated, San Francisco, and Eric Benjamin. The spectra and the maximum output levels for accurately reproducing low-frequency musical signals are determined from published research and new measurements. Analysis of commercial recordings shows substantial musical information in the octave from 32 to 16 Hz and some down to 12 Hz. Psychoacoustic data are used to establish to what degree errors, such as total harmonic distortion, FM distortion, modulation noise, and bandwidth limits, are perceptible. Criteria are set for proper subwoofer performance at a peak sound pressure level of 110 decibels. This work was begun in order to establish design criteria for the performance of subwoofers to be used for the reproduction of music in the home. Subwoofers are, by definition, low-frequency loudspeakers which are used to extend the lower range of the frequency range of high-fidelity loudspeakers. Our goal was to define specifications for a subwoofer which can reproduce the low frequencies found in recorded music without audible degradation. Published research on the perception of low-frequency sounds was used, and new experiments were conducted to augment those results where needed. It should be recognised that there are a great number of effects having to do with loudspeaker performance, and that this paper constitutes a survey of only some of them. It is not universally recognised that low frequencies play an important part in the reproduction of music. A very early study on determining the bandwidth necessary for the reproduction of music was published by Snow in 1931. A wide bandwidth, high dynamic range loudspeaker was used to reproduce the sound of musical instruments played live into a ribbon microphone. Filters with sharp cutoffs were inserted into the reproduction chain in order to determine their effect on the reproduction of various instruments. Low frequency extension down to 40 Hz was found to be important for reproducing timpani, bass viol, and tuba. Unfortunately, the absolute amplitude of reproduction was not used as a criterion for these judgments, rendering them somewhat subjective. Also, the pipe organ and its modern descendant, the synthesizer, were not included in these tests. At very low frequencies, the subjective impression of sounds changes from one of pitch to a sensation of pressure. Gutmann and Prusansky established the frequency at which this change occurs as being about 19 Hz. They also established a lower limit for musical pitch as being 60 Hz. Below 60 Hz, the ability to detect octaves and musical intervals becomes progressively weaker. Buck, using a more refined apparatus for reproducing very pure low frequencies, established the lower limit of pitch perception as 12 Hz. Low frequencies in music, when they are above the threshold of audibility, play an important part in the musical experience. The threshold of hearing at low frequencies determines the absolute lower limit for sounds that are audible for a desired playback sound pressure level. The actual lowest frequencies found in music, and in recordings of music, establish the practical low frequency bandwidth that must be reproduced. Once the needed bandwidth is established, the maximum volume excursion necessary for the subwoofer to reproduce the desired sound pressure level in rooms must be determined. Next, the criteria must be set for the maximum deviation from flatness of response, phase error, nonlinear distortion, and acceptable Doppler distortion. The effect of room response and the crossover of the loudspeaker system are also discussed. Hearing acuity limits. Problems of low frequency reproduction were examined with the assumption of peak sound pressure levels of 110 or 120 dB, and that the subwoofer would be crossed over to the full range loudspeaker system at a frequency no higher than 100 Hz. It is felt that these values are representative of the actual requirements and usage for home music reproduction. Compact disc survey for minimum audible frequency. Since the low frequency limit is determined by sine wave perception is a worst case, the next step is to find out what amplitudes of low frequencies are present in the actual recordings that might be reproduced through subwoofers. Possible sources include FM radio, long playing records, cassette tapes, compact discs, and hi-fi video cassettes. Of these types of media for recorded music, CDs have extended bandwidth and minimal distortion at low frequencies. Consequently, our survey was confined to CDs. CDs were selected from several hundred available for test, based on previous knowledge or by recommendation that they had substantial low-frequency content. Each CD was played by a CD player with a minus 3 dB cutoff at 3 Hz, and the recording was analysed by a Hewlett-Packard 3561A spectrum analyzer using a peak hold in each frequency bin. CDs that were found to contain high levels at frequencies below 30 Hz were retained for further analysis. Spectrum analyses were performed at the moment of maximum low frequency energy and plotted for study. The minimum audible frequencies based on the threshold of hearing and a maximum peak CD output equivalent to sound levels of 110 and 120 dB were determined for each of the 13 CDs selected for detailed analysis. Several general conclusions can be drawn from the survey. First, recordings with audible bass below 30 Hz are relatively rare. Second, these very low frequencies are generated by pipe organs, synthesizers, or special effects and environmental noises. Other instruments, such as bass guitar, bass viol, timpani, or bass drum, produced relatively little output below about 40 Hz, although they may have very high levels at or above that frequency. The third conclusion is that it is necessary to have a low frequency response down to 12.5 Hz, 16 Hz if the 1812 canon is eliminated, if peak levels of 110 decibels are to be reproduced, and as low as 10 Hz for peak levels of 120 decibels. And the record, the CD, which they found had got the maximum level on it, is a maximum frequency, a maximum level of 120 dB at 10 Hz in the Tchaikovsky 1812 overture, which is on the Telarc label, and the CD number is CD80041 of the 13 records listed here. And skipping the rest of the paper to the conclusions, music experiment for distortion audibility. An experiment was performed to test the criteria established for the audibility of harmonic distortion products. The music selected for this test was the Hindemith organ sonata recording. The last several seconds of this sonata contain a very powerful, sustained 19.375 Hz note. It was noted that the third harmonic of this note slowly varied, sometimes dropping to minus 40 dB. This section of the CD was transferred to a computer disk drive using a 16-bit ADC-DAC as the conversion interface. A digital signal processing program was written to add third harmonic distortion, proportional to the predicted loudspeaker excursion, and this was summed into the original program material at an adjustable level. The Stax Lambda Pro headphones and latex cap were used to audition the result, and the amount of added third harmonic distortion was varied to determine the threshold of audibility. The two listeners auditioned this 5-second music segment over and over again while they varied the level of the third harmonic distortion. The threshold was found to be about 2-3% of additional third harmonic distortion, and the subjective effect was that the swelling sound of the organ was changed and became more stationary as additional distortion was added. The effect of the room characteristics on subwoofer excursion requirements was also examined. This was done by comparing the subwoofer acoustic output in a number of rooms with that for a half space. It was found that the output in a room was similar in level to that measured at 1 meter in a half space, and that a substantial increase in room output occurred below 20 Hz. This output was significantly greater than the 6 dB produced by corner loading effects. Instead, the increase amounted to 15 dB at 5 Hz, and the extra output was hypothesized to come from boundary effects of the other walls. This increased output for the frequency range of 5 to 20 Hz was very helpful in reducing woofer excursion because a 16 to 20 Hz cutoff would be sufficient for low frequency reproduction down to 10 Hz in a room. Even so, the excursion requirement would still be 110 dB peak at 20 Hz. This translated to a quarter inch or 6 mm peak excursion for 4 15-inch woofers. Limits of the distortion and noise for the introduction of no audible nonlinearities were derived from auditory masking under single sine wave conditions. Harmonic analysis was found to be more useful than intermod distortion analysis because of the masking characteristics of the ear in the subwoofer range. The analysis of audible distortion and noise divided the output spectrum into one-third octave bands and compared it with the appropriate masked threshold spectrum for the ear. Masked spectra for 10, 20, 50 and 100 Hz were obtained from experiment and expressed in absolute acoustic levels or in relative terms reference to the fundamental. The components in the lower part of the frequency band with a threshold change due to masking combined together on a power ratio RMS basis, while in the upper part of the audio range each one-third octave band was independent. When expressed relative to the fundamental, the distortion limits for the lower harmonics varied as a function of level and frequency. Fortunately, higher levels yielded higher harmonic limits than lower sound levels. Overall distortion limits based on all the frequencies and levels surveyed resulted in the requirement that the second harmonic distortion be less than 3% and third harmonic less than 1%, and the higher harmonics should be less than between 0.3 and 0.1%. The irregularities of the room response were seen to affect these limits greatly for any particular situation. A number of loudspeaker systems were tested with the previously mentioned criteria in mind. Parameters such as low frequency cutoff or excursion requirements could be satisfied if an equalizer was used or enough systems were put in parallel to increase their volume excursion. Very few systems were designed to meet these performance requirements by themselves. More significantly, none of the loudspeakers tested was able to meet the distortion and noise criteria over the frequency range of 12 to 100 Hz. A dozen systems were tested and found inadequate. Due to the number of systems tested, it was possible to conclude that the previously discussed requirements would be satisfied rarely, if at all. It is hoped that this study will emphasise the importance of accurate reproduction in the frequency region below 40 Hz and convince manufacturers to improve their low frequency performance characteristics. Oh,
commentary by Ian McIntyre in The Times entitled Ruling the Wavelengths. The Home Secretary has decided to set up three new national networks for radio. An excellent idea. Who could be against it? On its way from Mr. Hurd's mind to the statute book, however, the idea seems to be gathering a few barnacles, and concealed amongst the barnacles there may be even one or two limpet mines. The summer recess would be a good time for Home Office officials to do a bit of scraping and revarnishing. The way to begin is by subjecting to critical scrutiny the second report of the House of Commons Home Affairs Committee, which decided last year that its main inquiry in the current parliamentary session would be on the future of broadcasting, and by translating what the interested parties say in their evidence into what they actually mean. The committee has received some very interesting submissions. A memorandum for the Royal National Institute for the Blind, for instance, with details about radio for the print handicapped from Australia, and about the overnight use of radio links in Sweden to transmit daily talking newspapers. Important evidence, and entirely straightforward. No need for translators there. There is evidence from Virgin Broadcasting, which ends rather smarmily by congratulating the committee on finding the time to examine the government's plans for radio in the midst of the main inquiry into television broadcasting. Two paragraphs earlier, however, its little limpet mine has been planted. We are concerned by the government's requirement that the new national stations should show internal diversity. Our belief, which is supported by those who wish to advertise on national radio, is that each new service needs to be carefully targeted to succeed. Put less virginally, what Virgin Broadcasting is saying is that the easiest way to make a quick buck is to put on a service of wall-to-wall pop and prattle in competition with Radio 1. There's a short, rather hurt note from the Independent Broadcasting Authority, the existing regulatory body which the government proposes to strip of its responsibilities. The IBA has the relevant ability, experience and knowledge. It has resources in place. The IBA is the body best able to develop radio effectively and rapidly in its next phase. Well, it's never nice to be jilted. And there is, inevitably, evidence from the BBC. The national instrument of broadcasting lacks a number of things, but it has almost inexhaustible reserves of corporate cunning. Over the years, it has deployed a sophisticated range of responses to the prospect of competition. Sometimes it has been a matter of cynical preemption. The classic instance in recent years was breakfast television. Here, its submission begins mildly patronisingly. The BBC generally welcomes the government's proposals for radio, but the deftness with which it attaches its modest limpet device makes Richard Branson's efforts seem bumbling and amateur. In determining which of its two frequencies should be surrendered, the BBC has sought to minimise the inconvenience to its listeners. Fancy. It has been suggested, particularly by some of those who may seek to become involved in the new commercial networks, that the Radio 3 medium wave frequency that the government plans to surrender is not ideal for any new network. This is the wavelength whose only appeal in the evening is to those who wish to brush up their Albanian. The BBC concedes that it's no great shakes after dark, although it rounds the figure for coverage up from 36% to 40%, but then grandly takes it on itself to assume that advertisers will be primarily interested in daytime coverage. When Mr. Hurd outlined the government's plans to Parliament at the beginning of this year, he said there were so many tastes and interests which existing services could at best satisfy, only to a limited extent. The three new national networks would be expected to provide a diverse service calculated to appeal to a variety of tastes and not limited to a single format. The intention, he said, was to provide the BBC with a stimulus of competition on a broad range of its services. If he wills the end, he must will the means, which is to say that he should call for a more generous reassignment of frequencies from the BBC. If the new services are seen to start life as poor relations, the prospect of running them will be attractive only to hucksters, and the result will be more of the same at the lower end of the market. It's difficult to see that would benefit the listener. Nor would it offer much worthwhile stimulus to the BBC. The Home Secretary would perform a notable service if he made it clear that in one of the new services at least, he would welcome a challenge to the BBC on the high ground of British broadcasting. It is territory of which BBC's radio stewardship in recent years has been a little more than absent-minded. The corporation is notoriously unwilling to cut its coat according to its cloth. As a result, it frequently finds itself overextended and fatally drawn to attempting too much with too little. Sweaty palms come into it too. Cockiness and confidence are not one and the same, and sweeping the board at the annual Sony Awards bun fight is not conclusive proof of a sense of editorial direction. The Home Secretary could change all that with remarkable ease. As that vintage radio performer Stanley Holloway might have said, "Pick up that musket, Douglas." That was a commentary by Ian McIntyre in The Times entitled Ruling the Wavelengths.
STC wins $10 million fibre optic cable contract by Hugo Dixon in the Financial Times. STC, the United Kingdom information technology company, has won a $10 million contract for the supply of an underwater telecommunications cable between Britain and the Netherlands. The company said the 155-kilometre cable will be the world's longest fibre-optic cable, not requiring electronic equipment in the middle to boost the telephone signals. Fibre-optic technology has been advancing rapidly in recent years, with the result that longer distances can be covered without the need to include electronic boosters, thus reducing the price of the systems. The new cable will be jointly owned by Mercury Communications, British Telecom and the Netherlands Telephone Company.
Now over to some letters we've received. First from Mr. Sixten Nyman from Nyckelby in Finland. Hope I've pronounced the town right. Says, thank you very much for the most interesting programmes. I have been listening to your station now and then during the past month and I have mostly no problem at all hearing Radio Facts. Thank you very much, and I give my best regards to all of you on Radio Facts. So we send them to you. That's from Finland.
And from Essex, please send information on your very interesting station. Thank you, R.N. Greenhall from Woodford Green, Essex in England.
And Mr. Jim Duffy from Maynooth, County Kildare in Ireland, wishes to compliment us on our unique transmission content. And now a strange happening, as reported in The Practical Motorist. Recently, we returned from a holiday in Dorset, and my wife and I had occasion to pass the radio transmitter at Rampisham on the A356 Maiden Newton Crookhern Road. We were travelling along the unclassified Higher Kingcombe Rampisham Road, map reference ST554008, when, without warning, the intermittent wipe on the windscreen wiper operated, just once. The wipers were not brought into continuous operation. The first time I put down to accidentally catching the lever, but subsequently virtually hands-off the wipers still worked, just once, on no less than about 10 separate journeys. Speed at the time approximately 10 to 15 miles an hour. Once in reverse, testing at about 5 miles an hour, the wipers operated three distinct times. The radio was on, the car a 1986 Austin Maestro 1.3 litre. Have any readers experienced a similar situation and can you give an explanation? Is it possible for the ignition system to be affected? With what results? I look forward to any replies. And that letter came from K.H. Ratcliffe from Swinton in Manchester.
And obviously it was significant that he had his radio turned on.
Thank you.